This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill at its lowest price ever and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first and only GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Based on advertised cash price for 30-day supply of medication only. Membership required. Fee not included, and billed separately. Weight Loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
Where's Fielder?
He's gone to the dogs.
Welcome once again to the Gone to the Dogs podcast. Steve Fielder here with you one more time. I want to thank my good friends Rob and Frank Giddings up in Twin Lakes, Michigan, up there around Muskegon, I believe it is, for bringing us on. As they do each and every week. Rob is the voice that is in the truck, pulls up, rolls down the window and says, "Where's Fielder?" And his dad speaks up and says, "He's gone to the dogs." Thank you, Frank and Rob, two great friends and just really great people. Just wonderful people to hunt with and to spend time with, and I'm hoping to see them. I'll let the cat out of the bag here, but I'll be attending UKC Walker Days this year with my good friends Randy and Troy Smith. I'll be up at Randy's hunt doing some hunting and be riding out to Walker Days with those boys, and I don't know who else is going along at this point, but looking forward to seeing a lot of you at UKC Walker Days. I can't tell you right now where the location is. I'm just riding along as I do so much anymore, but sure looking forward to that. Speaking of events, this week is as I'm recording this, the PKC World Championship, something that I was involved with intimately for about 7 years, is going on in Salem, Illinois. I'm recording this on a Thursday, which means that's the fourth night of qualifying. The format is you go out and hunt the early round. If you win your cast, you go back late. If you win that cast, then that gives you a ticket to the semifinals on Friday night. Maybe they call them quarterfinals. I'm not sure. But anyway, four nights to qualify, Monday through Thursday. And then all those doubled up dogs will draw out and cast on Friday night. And it'll be an elimination going forward. But anyway, PKC World Championship Week. Exciting times. Of course, the new world champion will have been announced by the time that you receive this podcast. Also, for my plot buddies around the country, especially in the eastern part of the country, the American Plot Association's annual breed days is going on this weekend in Greenville, Tennessee. My buddy and partner, Mark Miller, is already there and on this Thursday, and we'll be there through the weekend. Hopefully, our friend Cody Fox will be able to attend this year. Cody, as I've said in the past, has had a serious work-related accident, which he received a broken nose, a broken eye socket, some broken ribs, and he's on the mend, and I think he'll be there, but I can't be sure about that. My headphones are cutting in and out on me here. I may need to get another cord. Okay, I switched chords, and it does sound better on my end. I hope it's coming through to you guys. Anyway, I was talking about the American Plot Association Breed Days this weekend, and I'll have some more to say about that next week in the podcast. All right. This week had an interesting conversation on the Coon Hunting Conversations group on Facebook. I started this along with Alan Bridges back, I don't know when we started this thing, but it's been out there 3 or 4 years, I guess. And we're, you know, excited about the fact that we've got a lot of members in that group. I think there's somewhere around 12,000. And as we started that one out, we were determined to keep it clean, keep it free of advertising, keep the keyboard commanders, or commandos, as I call them, at bay, and just have some good dog talk, some good conversations. So this week I posted the following: who is the best coonhound pup trainer alive today? And I mentioned that I posed the question in last week's Gone to the Dogs podcast. Who is the guy or gal in your experience that has the knack of taking a green pup and making a finished hound out of it, either a top pleasure hound or a dog that can win at the higher levels of the sport? And then tag that question with a request that the comment also include why that you think they are the best. And is it their win records, their methods, their longevity in the sport, or what? Anyway, got 107 replies as of the recording of this podcast. So I thought that was pretty doggone good. My friend, a couple of friends that we go out to the White River with each fall, Trey Perrin from Alabama, the son of Jamie Perrin. Well, Trey posted that. He said, "My buddy Randy Smith." Now, that's Randy Smith of Black and Tan fame from down in Mississippi. He said, my buddy Randy Smith is pretty sharp with those black dogs. Just imagine what he could do with a white dog. The guys are always digging each other. Let's see. And there was a reply to that. Let's see. Oh, I guess that's just me saying that I agree. Randy Smith has the knack for sure. And if you go hunting with Randy, you'll understand why. Randy is a quiet guy. He's not out there, flamboyant, bragging, trying to show people what to do. He simply goes out there and handles his dog. I've competed in a cast or two with Randy. And, of course, as I said, I go each year out to the White River with him. Randy takes coon hunting dead seriously. He is a guy that likes to hunt a young dog, and he's had a lot of success in starting dogs, taking them up to where he feels like that they're ready to compete. He'll put them in the hunts. And if you come by and make an offer, and it better be a healthy one, he'll move the dog down the road. And he sold some mighty good ones. But Randy Smith, definitely a good dog man. Randy hunts a lot of young dogs. When I say a lot, he usually only has one in camp. But he'll hunt that dog up and get him polished where he's operating. And these dogs have brought some really serious money. I'm talking about five figures. And so anyway, Randy Smith, the Mississippi, definitely a good handler and a good dog man. Rod Burns hunts a really nice black and tan called Fred. And I've hunted with him up in Pennsylvania a couple times. And Fred is the real deal, no doubt about it. And he says, now, here we go with another Randy Smith. Randy Smith with the Lone Pine Walkers is always cranking out top dogs and hunting in an area where it's tough hunting. Well, you're right on both counts there, Rod. Randy Smith puts his stamp on those Lone Pine Tree and Walkers. And I've been there a couple times a year now for the last several years. And I see how Randy operates. And he definitely spends the time with these dogs. When I did the podcast last week about hounds and horses, we talked about how in the thoroughbred horse world, they keep track of the dams. They'll list the sire of a colt or filly, and then they list four generations of dams in their database. And I'm sure it goes back farther than that. But that reminds me of Randy. As you probably know of Randy Smith, we'll call him Pennsylvania Randy. If you followed him and the amazing success of these Lone Pine dogs, you'll see that he hunts females. You rarely see Randy hunting a male. I think he and Tom Strang, his partner, ran a stud dog named Cowboy that was out of Sackett Jr., he's more recently had the False Prophet dog out of Frogger and world champion Biffy Sue, Lone Pine Biffy Sue. But mostly he's going to be hunting females. And, you look at the truck winners, lady, Lone Pine lady, you look at the $100,000 winner. The $100,000 hunt winner, Lone Pine Bella, a female. You look at his female that was in several Final Fours, Lone Pine Million Dollar Baby female. His 2016 UKC World Champion, Lone Pine Biffy Sue, another female. But the thing about these Lone Pine dogs are they come down through the generations. They've all been born right there in Katanning, Pennsylvania, on Randy's farm. And but what Randy will do is he'll take a he'll pick a pup or maybe two out of each litter and hold those back. And he just has an uncanny knack of picking a good one because those are the pups that go on to win these big hunts. And so anyway, yeah, I'd have to agree with Rod Burns, a former Mr. Green Jeans, we get him, a former conservation officer that I enjoy hunting with when I go up to Randy's. And, man, he does have a nice black and tan. Okay, C.W. Eldridge, my blue tick buddy down in Georgia, he says, Steve, you know who was the best. And I didn't have to ask him. I knew that he was talking about the late Ed Mead from up at Springport, Michigan. Ed was a guru when it came to training puppies. He put out some videos. He had some kind of unique and orthodox methods, but he was absolutely successful in you know, in starting pups at incredibly young ages. I saw so many good puppies come through Ed's place. You know, I'd be over there and they'd be a litter there and they'd be 7, 8 weeks old and he'd have them treeing on scent, you know, and then they'd get up 3 or 4 months old and he'd run long drags or turn loose cage coons for them, and I've seen them run track incredibly long distances, swim ponds, and all kinds of things that you don't expect from pups that age, and see them come treat and stay treat on that coon. So, yeah, Ed Mead, definitely one of the better ones that I've encountered, and I think most people who knew Ed or ever hunted with him know that he was truly good. Eddie Muse, the black and tan man from down in Mississippi, he says that he thinks Randy Smith from Mississippi is the best that he's ever known. So there's another vote of confidence for Randy. Oh, on down we go. Alan Snedeker. We know Alan. He won the UKC World Hunt with the dog called Rock River Gap. He and Mike Parrish, his handler, he said Frank Giddings. Well, hey, no conversation about pup trainers or dog trainers would be complete without mentioning Frank Giddings. Frank has absolutely trained some of the very best in our sport and has kept generations of these dogs. And who could forget the great Sackett Jr. and so many more. And, yeah, Frank Giddings for sure deserves to be in any conversation about good pup trainers. I'm not going to be able to read all 107 of these responses. Just throw some names out here. Randy, or actually Rocky Tanner says Jerry Deal is pretty dang good. Pat Buderus says Daniel and Peyton Clipperton. They've sold many big name, well-started pups before, and sold the pups before they became big name dogs. And Drake Robertson says that Mark Sullivan has been making good ones for decades. Of course, we know Mark, his son Coy, PKC Hunters, a lot of good dogs have come through their hands for sure. And I've always heard that Mark was good. Billy Carter, who goes by Trammel Creek on Facebook, says Charles Wells is as good as they get. Now, I think I know Charles, but I really can't go into a biography on each one of these. Here's a name that's been around for a long time, and I first met this guy when he was handling a red bone dog for the late Roger Shable, and they won the Purina competition, a dog called Famous Amos. So Timmy Dutton says Roger Gibson has been training good ones for a long, long time. He's number one in my humble opinion. Well, Timmy, I think I'd have to agree with you, and I'm sure a lot of other people would too. And Ronald Henry says that Roger Gibson is the best dog man in the country, has been doing it for 40 years or more. Now, here is is a name that you'll recognize, and gentleman that we had on the podcast not too long ago, and his brother and his son. Carl Spillane says, Chuck Dunlap, look at the last few years, Hustler, Scream, Axe, Homer, and the list goes on. Okay, so Chuck, you got a fan there, and Carl Spillane, and there's no doubt that Chuck Dunlap is a good dog man. We have a fellow named David Barks. He said the best pup trainer is a good pair of boots. Well, there's a lot of truth to that. David, you have to train them, that's for sure. Now, my buddy Rusty Jones. Rusty and I have been friends for a long time. He was hunting dogs for Jess Dickerson when he was just a young fella in the PKC youth program. And we became friends back then, and I've enjoyed Rusty for sure. And he says here, the best ones are hard to find because they do it for other reasons. Nobody tells of the lake where they caught the 4-pound crappie. Certain ones need recognition, but others don't want it, if that makes any sense. Well, that's true, Rusty. You know, some guys don't want notoriety. They don't want to be singled out. Some of them are simply, more of a humble, some might even say introverted type of individual that just doesn't want the public attention. Others just do it because they love it, and that's, you know, recognition enough or reward enough, I should say. All right, but so I'm going on through these a little bit, and I guess I'm digging down in the weeds a little deeper than I intended to. Jordan Gambrell says Lyle Warren is the best I've been around. Very few over the years he's had a hand in that didn't make coon dogs. All right, Lyle Warren. Okay. Monty Caldwell says Ralph Tullis is 78 years old and still hunts 5 nights a week. Man, you got it on me, Ralph, because I am 79. I suppose if I lived in a little better environs than these Florida thickets and swamps, I might be out there a few more nights a week, but I'm not sure I could hack it 5 nights a week. Way to go, Ralph Tullis. Rocky Hodge says that Terry Scherer up in northern Indiana is the man, and I'll agree, Terry's a good one for sure. Jeremiah Lynch says nobody's a close second to James Wadley. James does quite a few posts on Facebook about dog training, makes some interesting points, and I've kind of been a fan of James. Jeff Philhauer says Clyde Gross is the man. Sean Maddox says Charles Wells, year after year. Okay, so you guys out there, I'm sure some of you, as you hear these names, you know them. And, you know, I can't comment one way or the other because I don't know some of these people. Here's an interesting point. Ron Moore says, most people will give names of the people they're most familiar with. To say who's the best is very hard to do. That's like saying who's the best dog without ever hunting with all of them. Training a pup is more than just hunting it till it reaches its potential. Most depend on the dog itself. Some pups offer more potential than others. The person that sees that potential without getting discouraged will usually end up with a coon dog. There are so many variables to training a pup. Well, I think you get the point on this. I mean, everybody has their favorite. This one was kind of interesting. I think I'll close with it. It comes from Chris Cornell, blue tick guy over in Virginia. He says, Mr. Wimp Wright in the hills of Southern Virginia has started to finished young dogs as many as anyone I've ever known. When you get a dog from Wimp, it's ready to win because it's right. Winning local hunts to Southeastern Tree and Walker Days to PKC Platinum Champions to UKC World Champions have come from Wimp's backyard. And around 84 years young, he still has the knowledge. He's my mentor. And his son, Boo Kaiser Winford Wright Jr., that's a mouthful, is carrying the torch. They are true dog men. Well, I think that pretty well sums up what most of us think, Chris, is that, you know, the guys that put the time in, the guys that spend a lot of time with their dogs. I would say that most of these trainers are not heavy-handed, demanding type people. I would rather venture to say that most of these good trainers are patient men and could be women as well. I'm sure there's some really good lady dog trainers out there. But anyway, spending time with the dogs, loving dogs, I think that's the key. You love the dogs. You love the sport. And that's kind of a segue into something I wanted to talk to you about a little bit here. At my age, and it's no secret that this year in the fall, I'll be 80. You know, there's a lot of reflection that goes on. There's a lot of looking back and thinking about things, and you wonder, you know, why certain things worked out the way they did. And all, you know, I guess that's just a cycle of life, is things slow down and you're not so much out there, you know, hustling the way that you might have done in the past. You have more time to think and reflect and so forth. And I've often asked myself, and I'm sure many of you have done the same thing, is, you know, what was it about this sport, about this hobby, this obsession of hunting with hounds that appealed to me so much that I made it my life's work and that I've, you know, loved it from the first time I can remember going until the last time I went, and I'm certainly looking forward to going here within a few days again. You know, just what is it that brings us into the sport? With me, of course, I've said many times, my father brought me into the sport. For many of you, it was a relative, a father, a grandfather, an uncle, a cousin, maybe a high school friend. Someone else introduced you to the sport, and there was definitely something about it that struck a nerve, so to speak, or you know, captivated you, so that you wanted to continue it for for many cases, for a lot of us, for several years, decades even. And that's a tough one, you know, to try to peel back all the layers of the onion and figure out just what is it down deep, you know, that keeps us involved in this sport. And time again, we say the people, but, you know, there are people everywhere, all kinds of things. You could meet people at a bowling league, or you can meet people in the military, or you meet people at church. There's a lot of ways that you can meet people and become friends with them, and you know, but there's usually something that you do together that kind of forms a bond. You know, whether it's a fishing buddy or, as in our case, a hunting buddy. And I've said so many times over the years, one of the greatest assets to a coon hunter is having a good hunting buddy, having someone that enjoys the sport as much as you do. And hopefully is as eaten up by it as you are. And I've had some friends like that, still do, and I've introduced several of them to you here on this podcast. But anyway, looking back for me, you know, if I sit down in my easy chair and prop my feet up and let my mind wander a little bit, you know, for me, it's always been the dogs. I've loved dogs since I was very, very small. I may have mentioned we went one time to visit a relative of my, I think this was, it was not my immediate relative, it was a relative of my uncle's wife, my Aunt Gay. Her brother lived in a little town called Clinchco, Virginia. And for some reason, we went there and we stopped and visited with them a while. And I can remember that they had I would say probably 8-week-old, 9-week-old, black and tan, old-fashioned, long-eared black and tan puppy. That puppy made a lasting impression on me. A hound with that kind of ears. I mean, you know the kind. If you've seen the old pictures, I mean, you can stretch their ears out, and you know, even at that age, it was probably more than a foot from tip to tip. But anyway, that hound, you know, and then later on, my folks gifted me with a beagle puppy named her Cleo, spoken of her here. And I'm not going down the long, long, long list of all my favorite dogs. Just suffice to say, hounds especially have always intrigued me. I enjoy them so much. And even in retirement, when I'm sitting around the house here, we've got a couple of dachshunds, and they're just little hounds is what they are. They have a hound head and hound ears and a hound attitude. So it's always been about the dogs for me. And I think for all of us, we'd have to say that that's the main thing. And then beyond just loving dogs and liking to rub their ears and watch their antics and see their loyalty and their faithfulness to us, we love to see them do what they were bred to do. And, of course, when you put all that together, with a well-bred puppy and getting him in, then taking him out into great outdoors, which is getting harder and harder to find each year. unfortunately for us. But I think the combination of the dogs and the outdoors and the raccoon or the bear or the bobcat or the bunny or whatever you put into the mix as the quarry, so to speak, it all comes together to form just this almost mystical experience. I've written over the years, or tried to write, my feelings about a hunt, what takes place out on the hunt, and try to express the adrenaline that you feel when you walk out there and reach down and unsnap that hound, and you watch him leave on a dead run into the night, surrounded by the shadows of darkness and perhaps the glow of a full moon, the buzz of the mosquitoes and the song of the tree frog peepers, the spring peepers. And as in the introduction of this podcast, the whippoorwills, and just to try to recreate that feeling of being out there at night and releasing that dog with the expectation that he's soon going to find a track, and when he does, he's going to bark. And that sound of that hound is the one thing, I believe, the single factor that most coon hunters would agree that brings them back time after time. The ability then to understand to communicate with the dog, to understand what the dog is communicating to you. All of that just comes together in such a, it's almost a spiritual way, and for those of us of faith, we certainly always at those times, we acknowledge that God has made all this possible for us. And we thank our Creator for making the night and for making the creatures of the night and for making the hounds and the coon and all of the aspects of this wonderful sport that come together. There's just so many facets to it. It's hard to put your finger on them all, but they all come together, whether it's listening to the howling of a distant pack of coyotes or the moaning of the whistle of a train at a crossing miles away, as you stand there in the dark listening for the voice of your hound. And then it goes into another level when you hear that wonderful locate, that distinctive bark that tells you the dog has found the coon, has found the tree that the coon's in. My friend Clayton Stark has gone to great lengths to record some of these locates on dogs with these phenomenal mouths. And it's worth a trip over to YouTube and click on some of Clayton's stuff, and you'll hear some phenomenal, phenomenal hound voices. But for me, that was the draw from the start for me. And that sustained me down through the years, even into my age now. Granted, I can't participate the way I used to. I can't follow a dog the way I used to. I cannot competition hunt, and I love to do that. I loved competition hunting. Just is not within the realm of physical possibility now for me. But it's something that I can go along as long as I'm not required to to walk at a pace that won't slow the cast down and can handle my dog and, keep things moving along the way. I used to with such ease, and now I just have to say, boys, I can't do it anymore, but still love it just the same, and I guess I always will. What is it for you? What is it about? Is it a young dog? I think a young dog probably excites us more than anything else. We have respect for the old dogs, and we get comfortable with the fact that they make it look easy. But then these young dogs come along, and the expectation each night of, is he really going to put it all together tonight? Is that switch going to flip tonight? He's been trailing, and he's been working the track, and he's been doing a pretty good job at it and all, but is he going to be able to find that coon in the tree and instinctively roll that trail bark over to a tree chop and sit there until I can come and pat him on the head and praise him? That's the expectation. And when we talk about these pup trainers, these guys have gone through lots of puppies, and they just seem to know, when the dog's doing this, maybe we should change things up a little bit. Let's set him up when it comes to young puppies. I would think most of them would agree that we want to set them up for success, and that means perhaps putting feeders out or taking them to areas we know that are inhabited by coons and giving them opportunities to run hot tracks and hopefully get after one in best case scenario be there when that coon scratch and bark climbing over that pup's head and that switch goes off, and there he is. It's just a great, great feeling. But anyway, whatever it is, there's something that once we get involved with this, for some of us now, not all of us do. Some are one and done. How many times have I taken people coon hunting, and they say, yeah, that was fun, but man, that's too thick, too rough, too many bugs, too much walking, on and on, it goes. But for those that, we've listened to many, many guests on this podcast say that, I went that one time and I was hooked. So we go from talking about trainers to talking about what has kept us in the game. It certainly hasn't been monetary rewards. And the game has changed so much. I was just looking, when I grew up there in southern West Virginia, we didn't have very many coons, but we had a coon hunters club. And mostly what we did for activities is we had field trials and we had water races and treeing contests. And a little later on, we started having what we call wild coon hunts. And we kind of went by the rules of the registries, which at that time, the main one was UKC. And early on, I became involved in the club. They let them talk me into being the secretary treasurer of the club when I was just in high school. It was a pain. I had to do all the advertising. I had to order the trophies and ribbons. I had to put the ad in the magazine and in the local newspaper, because that's how most of the hunters in my area, we had a little classified ad section in the back of the local newspaper. And we'd put an ad in there, and I'll remember them well. It said Wild Coon Hunt, Southern West Virginia Coon Hunters Association, Stanford Union Hall. Put a time and a date. And for more information, call. And that's kind of how we advertise. And, you know, it's kind of crazy considering how few coon we had there in those mountains. Now, we're talking a coal mining area of West Virginia. There's no big, wide cornfields and big river bottoms. What we had is coal-running swift creeks, maybe a little cow path up the side of the creek. You could hardly hear the dogs strike for the water running. We didn't have tracking collars. We didn't have any way really to keep up with the dogs except to know that if we turned them up the creek, that's the way they're going to go until they decide to come back down. Oftentimes you'd hear them strike, and you'd hustle to get closer to them because you knew they were more likely going to leave the creek and go uphill, either to the right or the left, and you wanted to be able to hear them. And a lot of times you could hear them pulling, as we call them, pulling out that face of that mountain, and then they'd go out of hearing, but we knew which way to go. But that was all the direction finding we had back in that day. But the other day I sat down in thinking back and made a list of the local area coon hunters when I was a kid there, belonging to the club. And it's quite amazing. 43. Now, I know a lot of coon clubs today have trouble coming up with 5 or 10 members. But I will just remember, these names came back to me. Lacey and Virgil Atkins, they were brothers. They lived in a little town called Piney View. A fellow named Bill Cheesebrew. I never knew, hunted much with Bill, except maybe at the club hunts, didn't know too much about him. An older hunter at that time, Dewey Moore, a local legend, so to speak, because he ran ads in Full Cry magazine. He would go around the countryside and find good dogs, advertise them in the Coonhound magazines, usually Full Cry. And his name was Chick Scarborough. Anybody from my area certainly remember Chick. There was Cliff Talbert. He was a local used car salesman for the Pontiac dealership. There was Bob Vest. He was a bloke who ran a local plumbing shop. Clarence Griffith was a Baptist preacher. Bill Ormandy, a local businessman who liked a blue tick hound and owned an appliance dealership there with some friends. It was called Doy, D-O-Y, and he was the O in that partnership. Howard Meadows was a close friend of ours. My dad, a World War II veteran, prisoner of war, coal miner, seriously injured, walked with a severe limp, but was a hard hunter. Ray Jennings, he was a friend of Chick Scarborough's, and they hunted together a lot. Dickie Todd, a younger fella. Billy Vaughn, they were both from the same part of the area out in that Piney View area. Bill Booth, also. I believe Bill might have been he was some kind of a salesman, maybe insurance, I'm not sure what. Then there was John Bolin, who was a barber. Seemed like every community had a coon hunting barber back when I was a kid. Sid Lilly, man, I tell you what, Sid Lilly had a dog named Lobo, and I told the story on one of my early podcasts about old Lobo and the Ramsey boy who couldn't quite talk plain and called him Wobo. There was a good story there. My good friend Winston Smith, that I hunted with quite a bit, and he had some plots back in the day. And Winston's been battling cancer, and I talked to Winston not long ago, and just ask you, good folks, to pray for my buddy Winston. He and his lovely wife Jan, just great folks. Terry Daniel from down around the Glen Daniel way, down in the area where Little Jimmy Dickens came from, the Grand Ole Opry star. Terry was quite a character and was the president of our coon club at one time. Here's a guy that was one of the slickest looking guys and always had a big handsome walker dog. His name was Woolsey Acord. W-O-O-L-S-E-Y, Woolsey, had a little pencil mustache, always hair combed to perfection, nicely dressed, a coon hunter that always had a pretty good dog from what I could tell. Couple of plot guys and still involved in the sport, still good friends of mine, John Sturgill and Les Bolin. They were, Carlos Howerton was another guy that I don't think I mentioned him. Yes, I did later on. But these were the plot guys besides me in the club. Jimmy Allen and his buddy Charlie Richmond. Boy, those guys were always together, always hunting together. They hunted walker dogs, and they were characters. And I always remember Jim, and hunted with Jim. One night we were hunting in Forest Hill on a night hunt, and his dog had to cast one, and we were sitting there waiting for the clock really to run out, kind of, and here come his dog down the creek carrying a possum. Jimmy was not a happy man that night. Bob Bolin. Bob hunted a red bone dog named Old Tom. And Bob was probably the only guy I knew that drove an International Harvester pickup, a red truck to go with his red dog. Bob was a character. I can tell you plenty of stories about him. I recently have become acquainted with Sam Harper from Eccles, West Virginia. Now, Sam's granddad, Adrian Harper, and his great uncle, Kenneth Harper, were redbone hunters and lived there in an area that we call Sand Lick, and were good hunters, good trainers. And I remember Kenneth was one of the first ones to set up the John Wick training method for deer breaking dogs, and he did a good job on a couple of those plot females that we had. Then there were the Mills brothers, not the singers, the coon hunters. There was Roscoe Mills, who now lives down in Alabama. His nephew, Link, his brother, Roger. I didn't mention, I don't think, his other brother, Eugene. They were all coon hunters, all kept good dogs, and were always at the hunts. Carlos Howerton, who was a friend of John Sturgill's, Ron Hayworth, another plot man. And so there's a couple of plot guys there in the mix. Herman Cox was a superintendent at a mine there called Slab Fork in West Virginia. Herman was one of the most interesting guys to hunt with, just a real prince of a guy, and always had a good hound. And we'd go hunt way back on Camp Creek State Forest sometimes, and we'd be out there walking half the night, and it would be late, and we'd get back to Herman's truck, and he had a camper shell on the truck, and he'd pop that thing open and reach back there and pull a cooler out on the tailgate. He'd open that thing up, and he had a grocery store in there. He had that, he called it miner's ham, that thick sliced bologna, a big fresh tomato, some, as we say back home, light bread, mayonnaise, a jar of mayonnaise, mustard, or whatever, any kind of thing you can imagine. And after you walked half the night in those mountains and you get back to the truck and get a feast like that, you don't forget it. Herman was a great guy, and I really loved to hunt with him. Junior Farley was the guy that I told the story about Lead, about his dog, where Junior would call his dog, and he'd be running a fox at the end of the cast, and Junior would say, "Oh, heck, just leave him. He'll be on the porch in the morning." So anyway, Junior, he was a character. There's Tobe and Ronnie Bauer. They were from down around that Bolt area of West Virginia. And here's Eugene Mills. I did mention him. I thought I'd forgotten him. Now, when I first started coon hunting, and I may have written about this in my book, we held the coon hunters meetings at the Stanford Miners Union, United Mine Workers of America's Union Hall in Stanford. That's just outside of Beckley. And it was right next door to a Metropolitan Insurance agent whose name was Dennis Wiley. Now, Mr. Wiley was a nice guy. He was an older gentleman, always dressed in a sport coat and tie because of his business. We kept the club raccoon there at Mr. Wiley's house, and it had a collar on it. And if you wanted to go do a little training of your puppies with a live coon, we'd take that coon out of the cage, lead it around, make a track for the pups. Buddy Bazzi, he was a fellow that was a friend of Winston Smith's, out again around the Piney View area. Ernie Gray, friend of my dad's and mine. We bear hunted with Ernie. I could tell you lots of stories about Ernie. He liked the blue tick dog, and later on in life he had beagles and some good ones. Then there were the boys from down on, I can't think of the name of the creek, down toward Whitesville, West Virginia. They lived, I went down there one time, drove all the way down. I thought I'd never get there to hunt with them. There were three brothers, Pete, Bill, and Vibert Dickens. And Pete's boy, Ricky Dickens. And they would come to our night hunts and would come up to the car lot there in Beckley at lunchtime when all the coon hunters would gather around with Cliff Talbert and tell their stories. But anyway, can you imagine? Now, there were probably more coon hunters there than I mentioned than were coons in that county. I mean, we had coon hunters back in those days. And they were all good hunters, you know, and they had good dogs. And a lot of times, you know, rather than just hunt around those old abandoned strip mines, coal mines there in the cliffs and laurel thickets and all, guys would have favorite places they would go in Monroe or Greenbrier or Pocahontas counties in the eastern part of West Virginia. And so we had quite a thriving coon hunter population. And this was in the 70s when I came home from the Air Force in 73 and was hunting in the hunts. And before, that's about 10 years before I went to UKC. Okay, well, I think I've rambled on. enough. Looks like we're working on an hour here. And I do appreciate the fact that you've let me do fly solo on these. I'm looking at the downloads, and they seem to be about the same. I know you'd rather probably hear some very interesting guests. And through the winter and all, it's kind of hard. Guys are either hunting or I guess they're just, you know, cabin fever set in. But as the events pick up and all, there'll be a lot more news out there to report. But I do thank you for staying with the Gone to the Dogs podcast. The numbers have stayed right up there, and we've been real pleased with that. And I know this is not a forever thing. You know, I have conversations with myself all the time. You know, should I just put this aside and not try to come up with something each week to talk about with you? But as long as you're still listening and the numbers say that you are, we'll keep providing these podcasts. I want to take this opportunity to thank my good friend Buddy Woodbury out at W Hunting Supply, who makes this podcast possible. We tell you each week about Buddy, and I will mention again the sweepstakes that he has going on there. Once you get it, go to the website, dusupply.com. Look at the information on the sweepstakes. You get, for each dollar that you spend with W, you get a ticket in the sweepstakes. And sometimes they run a deal, like, I don't know if it's still on now, but there was a deal on apparel where, you know, you got three tickets for each dollar spent. So go on to dusupply.com and check all that out. You'll be glad you did. Great folks to work with. Also, my good friend, Mark Zepp. MarkZepp.com. Lots of things to entice you to get off your wallet on that website. And as you know, Mark worked many years with Wick Outdoor Works, the late John Wick, and he brought a lot of that customer service and quality of merchandise that John was known for so many years. Mark brought it into his own company, markzepp.com. Check him out. You'll be glad you did. Well, folks, with that being said, I will remember my dear mother on this day that I'm recording, March 19th. That was her birthday. She would have been 104 years old today if she had not passed. She did live to be 100 years and 11 days. So, Mom, we think about you all the time, but we also want to think about you especially today on your birthday. A West Virginia coal miner's daughter married a plow, a farm boy from Tennessee. And as Paul Harvey would say, that's the rest of the story. Okay, folks, we'll check out next week. Hope to see you at Walker Days. This is the old coon hunter, Steve Fielder, saying, if you're looking for me, it's easy. I've gone to the dogs.